So this evening my intention is to complete with you the second part of the canticle, the spiritual canticle. It's numbers 19 to 21, but I'll just go back and summarise it for you again. As you recall, in the first one she says she's taking flight, and the bridegroom, Jesus, says, "Come, return, dove." Then there's those two lovely little stanzas which, in simple poetic terms, with little images, they intuit the intimacy of the communion that the bride and the bridegroom are having. But it's not complete yet, and it's distracted, and there's other things pulling at the person. But there is this betrothal promised and experienced. And so there's that business about catching the foxes and the wanting the north wind not to interfere, and basically for everyone to keep out and all the distractions, even people and whatever, to not disturb her in her communion with her beloved. So now we come to the last three, and it's number 19. So you've still got the, it's all from the point of view of the loved one, the woman in the picture, and Jesus is the beloved, and she tells him to hide yourself, my love, turn your face towards the mountains, don't speak, look at those companions going with her to strange islands. John suggests, he refers to 2 Corinthians 4, which I actually read to you this morning, how God has shone in our hearts. So she's asking her spouse, my love, to withdraw to the innermost part of her soul and communicate there with her in secret. And John writes, she can be satisfied only with God's face, which is a communication of the essence of the divinity to the soul. This communication is brought about only through a certain contact of the soul with the divinity. Well, we right at the beginning, we saw that God is actually the heart and the beyond of everything, including you and me. So she's going right into the very innermost part of her heart, and of course there is in contact with the Godhead, with God, with the energy and love which is God, emerging in our marvellous universe and including us. So she's touching on there the very central, I suppose it's the central doctrine of the mystical life, which is the indwelling Trinity, Father, Son and Spirit dwelling in the temple of your heart. So she's seeking for God, but of course if she wants to see the face, it'll need to be the face of Jesus. Staying with that same stanza, John writes, she's beyond images and thoughts now. Well, they come, but when they come, they're actually distracting. The images and thoughts cannot receive the communication which she desires. It has to be silent. Using my words but summarising what John says in his commentary. Fall in love, she's saying, with my soul, my deepest soul, which you have made beautiful with the graces which you have bestowed upon me. And I hope you can all see that that's what humility is, you know. I think we need to hear that a bit, because we were taught different things sometimes by people who didn't know. And no, your soul is actually beautiful. And it's the graces that have been stowed on you that make it beautiful, but God has made it beautiful. So, and these are the companions. These are the companions. These are the graces that alert you to who you are. Excuse me. Usually through other people and what you find yourself doing and their response to you and that heart-to-heart contact with them all allows you to see who you really are. And let me go to you, she's praying, in ways that are beyond the scope of imagination and thought. Strange islands, unfamiliar places, places that cannot be confined or controlled or even expressed, but they're real. That's what she's longing for, that silent communion. Later in his commentary on a later stanza, John of the Cross writes, this is what's happening, transforming her into his love. So there's a transformation happening. God gives her his own strength by which she can love him. And I think this is a wonderful image, really. As if he were to put an instrument in her hands and show her how it works by operating it jointly with her. When I was chaplain at the university, I taught myself, that's overstating it, but I taught myself the guitar, and I used to be able to play it, as long as you don't mind strumming, nothing fancy, but I used to play it. I haven't played it for years, I haven't got the energy now, but I did, but I also used to teach little kids sometimes, and you'd know if you've ever taught an instrument to a kid. So here's me, here's the kid, and there's the guitar. So you've got your arms right around trying to tell them where to put their fingers, and you're putting them there, and there you're kind of half playing it with the child. Well, I think that's the image he's got there. So God has given you your heart, but he's teaching you how to play it, how to strum on it, or how to breathe on it if you're into flutes and things. He's teaching you to play the instrument, which is your heart. John goes on, he shows her how to love, teaches you to love. Love meaning give yourself. Well, if you haven't got a self to give, you can't love. So you have a self. Giving that real self, not the self you wish you were or should have been or could have been if you hadn't, all that stuff. And no, it's now, whatever you are now, your heart now is quite capable, thanks to God, of love. So he says, let me show you how to love with your present heart. In the dark night, John writes, you must be content simply with a loving and peaceful attentiveness to God. And you must live without the concern, without the effort, and without the desire to taste or feel him. That's very important, isn't it? Because we can be tempted to want the desire, feel the desire, to want the taste, to want to feel. No, we must want him, the mystery, not how we feel when we are in communion with the mystery. In other words, we don't love the feeling of loving, we love God, or another person for that matter. All these desires to feel good, look good, whatever, they disquiet the soul and they distract it from the peaceful, quiet and sweet idleness of the contemplation which is being communicated. Now here, I wish I was wiser, but you've got to take me as I am too. So there's something in there, well, I'll just tell you, that disturbs me about, and maybe I misunderstand a bit, about this Maranatha kind of prayer. Anyhow, for what it's worth, there's something in there that seems a bit funny. And John of the Cross and Teresa, so let me assume I'm misunderstanding it, but they talk about the fact that you can't produce this silence. They're not talking about something we can do. Now, we can produce a kind of silence by breathing and breathing out, and there's psychological stuff we can do to go into a quiet place and we can quieten the mind. All this you know and I know, and you probably know a heck of a lot more about than I do. But that isn't the silence he's talking about. John of the Cross is certainly not talking about something you can do. It's not a technique and it's not an art. There may be a place for that, just it might help your heart rate. So there's a place for, but he's talking about the silence that God gives you that you can't manipulate or organize. And I'm sorry I said all that about the John Main method of prayer, because it must have a value. A lot of people find it has value, and one of you or two of you will come up after and explain it to me, I hope, so that I can see the value of it. But I am trying to say something important as well. Granted that, and I remember talking to a priest once who was having all kinds of trouble in prayer. He was coming to me for spiritual direction, for what it's worth. But his problem was that he'd been years and years saying Maranatha, and that. So I just said to him, scrap the bloody thing. I said, grab the gospel, look at Jesus in the gospel and meditate on a scene. That's a bit... Well, he did. He said, oh God, thank God for that. He felt released to actually pray with Jesus and the image of Jesus and the simple gospel stories that helped him. So there can be a trap in it. Let's assume it's good. And I've said too much already. So we'll come back to what John of the Cross says. You must be content simply with a loving and peaceful attentiveness to God, and live without the concern and the effort and without the desire to taste or feel him. Pure contemplation, says John in Living Flame, is in receiving. We were taught it was better to give than to receive, I think, something like that. And that suited my temperament, I suppose, and probably suits a whole lot of people. But as you know, and I have learnt, it's actually sometimes a lot deeper and more harder probably for some of us to receive than to give. We like giving, but to receive is a very loving thing to do and very humble thing to do and very meaningful thing to do, because we're receiving everything. So pure contemplation is not something we're doing. It's receiving something and making space for it. Yeah, we've talked a lot about that. Clearing the ground for it, yes. Working on our obedience and our detachment and our humility and our obedience. I don't know what else. Was it love? Yes, this is a constant thing, but that... this is welling up from within us. This is God's gift. This God's silence. God is carrying you, says John. That's why, although you are in fact moving at God's pace, you don't experience moving. Because he's carrying you. And you probably all know that. Is it the Desiderata? Is that what they call that prayer about the being carried? So, in general terms, I think, contemplation can be defined in this way. Well, I'm defining it in this way for you, and hopefully it's close enough to something right. A loving communion in which the heart is awake and attentive and the mind rests in knowing. Got an image coming to my mind of a cat looking at a bird in a tree. Every single bit of the cat, as you know, is totally attentive, after that, hoping to get hold of it, or the lion and the tiger and so on. So it's that kind of attention. It's a very attentive thing, but it's restful in knowing, and to know in the Bible means to be in communion with, in this communion. So it's not unattentive, and it's not empty, and it's not nothing. It's very attentive communion. John talks about, the scholars talk about, three kinds of contemplation. Aesthetic contemplation, they talk about. The delight we have when we experience beauty and sense that we're one with it. So you go on holidays down the south coast and there's this, you're just driving along or something and there's this wonderful sunset or beach scene or something. And it isn't, you're not just looking at it and thinking, isn't this wonderful? You sense that you belong to it. It belongs to you. You're caught up in it. Ecstatic in it, maybe a good word. But you're one with this. Or you're sitting under a tree in winter in the night sky and the tree is kind of reaching up into the heavens and it's bare, but you feel you belong to the tree and the tree belongs to you and the stars belong to you and you're part of this universe, and you sense a kind of a élan vital, I don't know what to put in English, but yeah, an energy or something of belonging to the universe. That's aesthetic contemplation. He talks about intellectual contemplation. And that's the delight we experience through insight. You're struggling with something, and then somebody uses words and you think, oh, that's it. And there's a release of the mind and you catch something that you must have known already, but it wasn't that clear. And then someone else, a bit of music or a homily you might hear, or it could be anything, or a friend says something, or something happens on the television or something, and suddenly there's an insight. You actually see, your mind says, ah, like Archimedes leaping out of the bath in Syracuse, but I hope you're more modest than that. But in any case, he suddenly worked out how to work out whether the crown was all gold or, you know, the story. The delight we experience through insight, and it's a wonderful thing, insight, you know that, because usually our problems are, the problem why we have problems is that the knot is there and we don't know how to undo it. It's made up of proper strands and everything, it's all real, but it's a problem, and sometimes a knot will just, well, you do that with your rosary beads, don't you, sometimes you pull them out of your pocket. And then you might do one little thing and suddenly it all falls out and it's fine. Otherwise you're tugging and tugging and tugging. But sometimes in insight, things can become clear. It includes the delight we experience in accepting the truths of faith and enjoying the light which they radiate. And thirdly, there's the contemplation that we're talking about, where, and I don't know how better to put it than this, God is experienced not as an object, but as a subject. This is the marvelous. I remember getting this insight when I was 18 in the seminary. We went through all these things. How do you know you see? And then you get these philosophers who have all this junk they're going on with. And how do you know when you're knowing? Because you're knowing with your own mind. And you go and you can spin around forever with that little problem till you suddenly realise, as I suddenly realised, thanks to the philosophical help I was given, that the wonder of human thinking is that when you actually know, when you or I know, in the knowing of the object, in that one very actual thing, not by reflection, you can reflect later, but in the very knowing, you know yourself as subject. You're not reflecting back on yourself with the mind and then going round and round and round in circles. It's a bipolar thing. You actually experience yourself knowing something. And there it is. You can't go deeper or further than that. It's just a basic factor of human consciousness. Well, when God is experienced not as an object, because God isn't an object, God just isn't an object. If we're making God an object, it's not God, it's an idol. Because God's the heart and the beyond of everything we have, including yourself. If God were an object, you could have God and the tree and the star and whatever. Well, you haven't got God. So when God is experienced in the same way that you experience yourself knowing, that's contemplation. For we experience ourselves as being one in a communion of love with the very source of being. Well, that's a wonderful feeling, isn't it? Because then you belong. You may not belong in the community you're in by chance. It just happens that you've ended up in a community with three very dysfunctional men. That's just to let you all off the hook. It could be. And in fact, you might be too functional yourself. So it's a pretty dysfunctional little place. So maybe there's not much communion going on there. Or there mightn't be much communion going on in the church that you kind of given your life to. And you go and you see all these. But I remember the first time I was in Adelaide, really. I was helping the Archbishop, or thought I was helping him. We were receiving catechists and he was blessing them all. And we had the altar. I'll never forget this because it was so bloody awful. We had the altar behind us and we're sitting here and we've got about six men dolled up in drag in what men wear at Mass. So we're all there and all the catechists that were coming up, let's say there were 15 or something, they were all women. And they were kneeling on the top step. And the bishop's lovely, Bishop Faulkner. You would never get a nicer man than Bishop Faulkner. So, but it's just the situation was so crazy and awkward. What was I going to do? Walk out? No, that'd only make a scene. But I thought, I'm never going to do this again. Because it was just so silly. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? It's like, you understand better than I do. But it was really just so silly. The church is very dysfunctional. I may not say too much more because I just remembered I'm recording all this. You can finish off the sentences for me. This is the Carmelite Marie Eugène in his book I Want to See God. It's about Teresa of Avila. But he has these two statements which I think you might like. Out of the darkness of the mystery, and it is a mystery, you're a mystery, everyone else is a mystery. That's why we don't judge other people, isn't it? Because we don't know where they've come from. We don't know how they were treated as teenagers. We don't know what happened to when they were in the womb. We don't know how they were hurt by their kids around them in primary school. And we don't know what Sister Esmeralda might have said to them that's still hurting them now. You know what I mean? If there's a Sister Esmeralda here, I'm sorry. I don't mean you. But so we don't know what they've been through to make them so fragile and hurtful even now. So we've got to somehow have a compassionate heart for the people around us and realise that, look in a mirror, and then we realise we're not that functional ourselves maybe. So let's be gentle with each other as best we can. And if you can't be gentle, walk into the other room. Don't stay around. I think we're allowed to avoid situations that we can't cope with, aren't we? Or am I just... There's flight and fight, isn't there? I'm into flight. And I think it's not a bad thing to do, to be quite honest. I love people who can fight, and I think, how do they do that? How do they just come straight back and like that? And I can't do it. But anyhow, I think enough. Out of the darkness of the mystery, there arises through the gifts of the Holy Spirit, says this saintly man, a confused light. And I know not what, that makes one find peace and sweetness in the mystery, that holds faith there, it'll always be faith, and brings it back, freeing it from the discursive operations of the intellect. Beautiful thing, our intellect, but it's got limits. And causing it, the intellect, to just shut up, find rest and support in this light that is beyond all distinct lights. A knowing that's more profound than intellectual insight, a knowing through communion in love. He goes on to say, the soul finds itself calmed, enveloped by another in a mantle of recollection. A gentle force holds it in recollection, a kind of what Simone Weil calls the gravity of grace, a gravity. The master himself creates a disposition of silent attention and peaceful submission. Well, I hope you can recognize that. Kavanagh, one of the translators of John of the Cross's writings, has this to say in another book, which is on Teresa of Avila. This contemplative prayer begins with a passive experience of recollection. This is quite beautiful. A passive, that is a received experience of recollection, a gentle drawing of the faculties inward. So your busy little minds and busy feelings and busy this and whatever, and you experience a gentle drawing inwards, and that's Jesus drawing you to himself. And that's, at its simplest level, contemplation. Now, these are my words, but they're drawn from study, obviously. Our attention in contemplation is not focused on the insights received. That's a real danger for me. It might even be for you. But I'm always giving lectures and writing and talking. So if I get a nice idea in prayer, I want to go and write it down and give a homily on it. But that's actually, that's not prayer. You can write prayerfully, can't you? And you can preach prayerfully. I hope what I'm doing now is prayerful. But it isn't prayer. Prayer is communion with God. So our attention in contemplation is not on the insights, important as they are. And our intention is certainly not on any accompanying psychosomatic phenomena. And in his day, as I've said to you, that was very important. Every second sister in the convent was running around having ecstasies or whatever, because that was the Spanish thing to do in the 16th century. However impressive thy might be. So if you go to prayer and you find yourself, or someone else knocks on the door and finds you levitating, well, the best thing to do about it is, I don't know, just accept it. You can't stop it, I presume. So just stay levitating. But it's not important. Well, you're all laughing as though you've never done it. That's all right. I mean, people do levitate. Some saints, seemingly, I've never seen it. But we don't knock it, and it's something extraordinary, but it's of no importance at all. So we don't pay any attention to it. That's the advice of John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, and they ought to know. Our attention in contemplation is on God, who brings about the transforming union effected by love. So in contemplation, we're purified, enlightened, illumined, and united to God in love. And love is the will. Love is the wanting to be with. We are transformed into love by the all-consuming love which is God, like a log being transformed into flame by an all-consuming fire in the fireplace. So contemplation is the glowing of the coals. In contemplation, God communicates a secret wisdom which he infuses into the soul through love. And it's sustained above all by peaceful surrender and humility. Let's listen to Edith Stein, the Dutch, or was she German? German. She was captured in Holland, wasn't she? Yeah, Edith Stein, the Carmelite, who became a Christian and then became a Carmelite. And she became a Christian because she knew these. She was an atheist, declared atheist for quite a while, and philosophy. And then I think it was because she met this couple who were Jews who had become Christians. And he had either just died or was sick. I'm sorry to be so vague on it. But when she met them, the woman involved, the wife, had a profound peace about this. And she saw it as carrying the cross. And Edith kind of was caught up in this extraordinary experience of a woman who had something she didn't have, a deep, profound peace and awareness of the cross and of the love of Jesus. And that kind of got her. She broke out of her mental thing. Anyhow, listen to what she says in her book, The Science of the Cross. John of the Cross writes for contemplatives whom he wants to take by the hand, hopefully you and me, at a definite point of their way. At the crossroads, where most of them are perplexed and they don't know what to do. Because in a way, in the way they've so far pursued, they're suddenly confronted by insuperable obstacles. Meditation isn't working, whatever. The new way that opens up before them leads into, or through, impenetrable darkness. Who would be brave enough to enter on this path, says Edith Stein. The two roads in question are those of meditation, thinking your way through things, and contemplation. So far, the hour of meditation has been devoted to exercising the powers of the soul, perhaps according to the Ignatian method, and all this is, of course, excellent. We've used our senses, our imagination, our memory, our understanding, our look at all the words beginning with O-U-R, they're ours, our understanding and our will. Nothing wrong with any of that. It's marvellous. But now doesn't work anymore. Our efforts are in vain. The spiritual exercises, until then a source of interior joy, now become a torment, unbearably arid and ineffective. That's one thing that's happened. Secondly, she's drawn all this from John of the Cross. On the other hand, there's no inclination either to take interest in anything else. Though this isn't working, and you're not interested in doing anything else, you still want the love and you want to be in communion with God, and that's it's your prevailing interest. And thirdly, the soul would like best to be quite still, without moving, letting all its powers rest. Brackets, and maybe this is what the John Mayne method of prayer is helping us to, perhaps, as long as we don't use it as a technique. But this doing nothing seems like sloth and waste of time. This, says Edith, is the state of the soul which God wants to introduce into the dark night. And that's where John was an expert, and he takes us step by step through that bewildering journey. It's only dark because you're looking at God and your eyes have gone blind, like you look at the sun, you can't see anymore. So the dark is actually good, but unexpected. And John writes in his Ascent, and repeats it in The Dark Night, he says, "Take pleasure in being alone and wait with loving attentiveness," that's the key. You're not doing nothing. It's a loving attentiveness. Wait upon God. Without making any particular meditation, in inward peace and quiet and rest. The experience, these are my words now, the experience of contemplative prayer is before else an experience of love. And you know I'm not talking about feeling in love, I'm talking about love. We experience God's love, which has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us, Paul, Romans 5:5. Like a drop of water, we're drawn into the ocean and absorbed into it. That's an image he uses. Being an experience of love, there is joy there, a sense of belonging, a sense of communion, a sense of peace. This is the love for which we're made and for which we long. And Teresa says to her sisters, to us, the important thing is not to think much, but to love much. Love means do God's will. Commit yourself to do what God is calling you to do as far as you can discern it. Love doesn't consist in great delight, but in desiring with strong determination to please God in everything. John of the Cross, in Try to Help Me and Help You in This Place, he uses an image of light, a dust, light coming into a room, and there's, of course you'd never find this in a convent, but anyhow, my brother said about his wife, he died a couple of years ago, he said, no, dad, about Mary, he said, she catches the dust before it hits the floor. Her home was, and at one stage, because she'd had an accident at tennis, he, she could listen to this, she'll get on to me for this, but anyhow, he thought to help her, he'd get someone in to do the cleaning. Absolute waste of time, because she had to have it spotless before the person came in to do the cleaning. Now, put your head up if you're like that. No. So, but you know what I mean? That's the image of light coming into the room and there's dust. Well, if there's nothing to block the light, we don't see it. But when there's dust in the air, the obstruction makes visible the direction of the beam of light. We all know that. The obstructions are real, the dust in your psyche and heart and life. But let's not concentrate so much on the dust that we forget that we see the dust only because God is bathing us in light. It's the only reason you see your faults. It's the only reason you go to reconciliation. So don't be so downhearted about seeing your faults. It's marvellous that you've seen them. The worst faults, fancy me saying this, but the worst faults are the ones you haven't noticed. Because they're really a problem. We're not to let distractions focus our attention. There's often nothing one can do about them. We're simply to continue to surrender ourselves into the arms of love. We're called to believe that God is shedding his light upon our souls at a level below experience. We're noticing the dust, so we believe. We actually know. Believe means you know in faith. We know that there's light entering. And that's a great gift. It's God's light enlightening us. And once again, Edith Stein. Haven't seen this done better anywhere else. Well, obviously she knew what she was talking about. Spells out the elements of John using this symbol of the night. She does all the time. Oh, delightful night, obscure, all that. And this is what she says. You'll associate with this quickly. On the one hand, night envelops us and envelops all things. It threatens to swallow us up. What it hides is still there, but is indistinct, invisible, without form. Night impedes movement. It paralyzes our faculties. It induces fear. It condemns us to solitude and is a foretaste of death. for you brave women, some of you might be rattling around a convent with 20 rooms in it and you're on your own. Go and get out, I'd say. It's too hard, but, you know, rattling. The night can have all that there, but on the other hand, she says, night softens and smooths what is hard and sharp or crude. Night reveals subtle features which are lost in daylight. Night drowns out the noises of the day. It quietens the spirit. Freed from the busyness of the day, and it gives deep and gentle repose. So it is, writes Edith Stein, with the mystic night of contemplation which arises from within the soul. And now for the second time in the canticle, just right now, in the last two stanzas of the second part, which is about betrothal in love, the bridegroom speaks. So the bride's been doing all the talking, except for that one little line, and now the bridegroom speaks. Swift-winged birds, lions, stags and leaping roes, mountains, lowlands and riverbanks, waters, winds and heat, watching fears of night. By the pleasant lyres and the siren's song, I conjure you to cease your anger. Do not touch the wall, that the bride may sleep in deeper peace. So this is Jesus telling the whole of creation to leave her in this communion of love. John writes, the bridegroom speaks these two stanzas in which he completes the purification of the soul, strengthening and disposing the bride in both sensory and spiritual parts, in her feelings, her memory, her imagination, but also in her mind and her will, preparing her for spiritual marriage. And spiritual marriage starts in stanza 22, and we'll look at it tomorrow, best we're able. So let's look at that more slowly. Stanza 20. Swift-winged birds, lions, stags, leaping roes, mountains, lowlands and riverbanks, waters, winds and heat, watching fears of night. John comments, she must hold the door of her will open to the bridegroom that he may enter through the complete and true yes of love. Like Mary, yes, be it done unto me. Again he says, because God vitally transforms her into himself, all her faculties, all her appetites, desires, etc., and all the movements lose their natural imperfection. God strengthens her against cowardice, which causes her to hold back. And it quietens disturbances and inordinate activity of the passions. Even recollection of sin no longer distracts or causes sorrow or grief. John goes on to comment, your will be done. That's the place to be. A spring welling up to eternal life, he reminds us of that. The promise, if only you knew the gift of God, if only you knew the gift of God, if only I knew the gift of God. All new joys and satisfactions serve to awaken her to a delight in what she already possesses and experiences within herself. She's come home to her heart, where he dwells. And stanza 21, I'll conclude with this. I'll read it again and then. By the pleasant lyres, the guitar, the lyre, and the siren's song, I conjure you, cease your anger, do not touch the wall, that the bride may sleep in deeper peace. Bride, sleep, awaiting for the love of the bridegroom, the married love. Do not disturb, this is from the Canticle of Canticles, do not disturb or awaken the beloved until she wishes. So following these words of the bridegroom, the bride enters the state of spiritual marriage. Stanzas 22 to 40. So we're actually only halfway through the canticle, and we've spent 5 days, for obvious reasons, I hope. The next half, you'd do better to listen to some mystic. So I'm just giving you one day to take you through as best I can the last 20 stanzas, because I actually don't know anything about them. But they're there, and they're for our knowing where we're called, and it's good to hear them once if you haven't heard them before. So stanzas 22 to 40 speak of this experience, the experience of spiritual marriage, which is John's term and Teresa of Avila's term. It's been a long, courageous journey into the centre of her soul. And it's made possible, this journey, only because it has been, from the beginning, a journey of love.